Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome Candace Taylor. She is the author of the book Counterculture, The American Coffee Shop Waitress. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
It's great to have you, and I love that we're talking about the American Coffee Shop Waitress while I'm sitting in a coffee shop here in Santa Fe. This is a book about women who have really chosen the career of waitressing. They aren't just doing it, biding their time while they do something else. Some of them have been at this for 50 years or more. How did you get into this whole subject?
I was actually waitressing to get through graduate school. I was getting a master's degree in visual criticism from the California College of the Arts in San Francisco. And I, like many college students, was waitressing to pay the bills. And I was 32 at the time. And I thought, you know, after a busy Friday night, I was so exhausted by the work. And I would sit down with my coworkers in the back and we would commiserate about how bad we, you know, felt and how tired we were. And I thought, well, how do women in their 60s and 70s do this job, especially the ones who've been slinging hash in diners their whole lives? And, you know, how do they feel about their jobs? And I did some research and found that very little had been written about this particular subculture and decided to make it my thesis for my master's degree. And then I graduated in 2002, and the project just really took off, and I was still really fascinated with these women. I wanted to continue working on it, and I have, and it's, what, almost 9 years later. So here I am.
And part of the book, of course, is these wonderful portraits of women who've been at it for a long time that you took yourself. They're pretty much, it's all your photography, is that correct?
Yes. The only photography that isn't mine are photos that I scanned that are vintage photos of the waitresses from their younger years. But yes, I took all the photos.
So one of the things I was thinking about, the book Nickel and Dime in America by Barbara Ehrenreich, and one of the things that I loved about that book was at a certain point, having worked, that author, Barbara Ehrenreich, as a maid and as a Walmart worker and all sorts of things, she comes to the conclusion there is no such thing as unskilled labor. It doesn't exist. Waitressing turns out to be not only extremely skilled labor, but really a calling for these women.
Yes, definitely. And that was something that, you know, I knew that waitressing wasn't an unskilled job because I was doing it. You know, I realized that not everybody is cut out to do this job. And I was a good waitress. I wasn't a great waitress. For these women, you know, it's not even so much that you need skill. You do need skill, but you also have to have kind of an innate sense of humanity in a way. I mean, these women can read a person, a stranger off the streets in seconds. They know whether or not they want to be left alone or they need extra attention. It's a special, almost sixth sense that these women have. And, you know, that's why I think a lot, it's a disservice to the service industry, is that the illusion that anybody can do this job. Most people are not cut out to wait tables, especially for a lifetime, like these women.
What were some of the stereotypes that you were facing within yourself when you started this project, and what turns out to be the truth or falsity of those stereotypes about waitresses?
Oh my gosh, there's so many. I'd say, you know, definitely when I was first seeking out the classic diner waitress, you know, I had so many images in my mind of Flo and, you know, the waitress and Easy Pizza, you know, it's Five Easy Pieces. There's just so many markers. You know, these women are icons of American culture. They're in so many films and television shows. And so I thought, you know, I might find that older, wisecracking, gum-smacking waitress and realize that, you know, really that's not what these women are about. They're much more kind of fleshed out and interesting. But I had that image in my head. I also thought that these women were going to be, struggling and sad and kind of broken down physically and financially. And I learned that that wasn't the case either. Many of these women who had been working in the same diners and coffee shops for up to 50, 60 years assured me that, you know, the waitressing actually is keeping them younger. They're aging well. They thought, you know, well, a lot of them did try to retire. After retiring and sitting at home for a few months, they realized that, you know, they were cut off from their connections with their regulars. They started getting depressed. Their bodies ached from arthritis because they weren't moving. And ironically, you would think that the labor of waitressing would, you know, weigh someone down or just physically wear their bodies down. But for these women, you know, one waitress, Ina Capitan, in the Florence, Massachusetts, at the Florence Diner, she was 84. She was the oldest waitress I interviewed. And she said, you know, she had rheumatoid arthritis, and she said, if I didn't waitress, I would be crippled because I need to keep moving. So that was a realization. I did several workshops throughout the country on career waitresses as models of healthy aging, because I was so just astounded that, you know, it was the opposite of what I had assumed. And the other assumption I'd made was that these women were going to be financially struggling, and I learned that was not the case either. For a lot of these women who've been working in the same restaurants for many years and have developed a local following who tips them very well, and they've paid their dues, they're making a higher hourly wage in a lot of cases because they've been at the same restaurant for so long. A lot of these places are family-owned. So they were, you know, living really solid middle-class American lives. They had children who were college-educated. They owned their homes. They drove newer cars. You know, it was not what I thought I was going to see.
There is, as you write in the book, this whole difference, I guess you would call it difference in expectations. These women who were born in the 20s and 30s really had different hopes and dreams about their own lives than their children or grandchildren, and that played a role in their career choice.
Yes. There's a chapter in Counterculture, The American Coffee Shop Waitress, that's called The Generation Gap. And, you know, it really looks at this kind of newer generation who is also waitressing. And I'd have to say, out of all the questions that I ask these waitresses, you know, it's a generalized statement, but it's mostly true that for this generation of women, they're not really complainers. And it was kind of like pulling teeth to get them to tell me to complain about the job. And I would say, look, you know, I've done the work. I've been there. I know how it is to have a hostile customer or to have somebody run you around. You know, doesn't that frustrate you? And they would say, yeah, but, you know, there's more good than bad. And, you know, but the one thing that they all complained about, I would say 99% complained about, was the younger waitresses. They said that, you know, they didn't work as hard. A lot of them just flat out said they were lazy, and that they weren't committed to the job in the same way. This was something that they were just going to do for now, and then they were going to move on with their lives and get quote-unquote real jobs. And that was kind of a slap in the face to a lot of these women who had made this a career and took the job really seriously. And like you were saying, they really did have a different expectation around work and around the role work was supposed to play in their lives. You know, for my generation, I'm 38 now. You know, I was taught that I was supposed to go to college and get a real job and have a real career, and that's great, you know. But for this generation of women born in the 20s and 30s, a lot of these women were suddenly divorced that are in the book and suddenly had to become the breadwinners when usually men were the breadwinners of that generation. And they found that waitressing actually helped them to support their families. And that was very empowering for these women. And they thought, well, I'm making a good living. I'm able to support my kids. What else do I need? They didn't really need the status symbol that we seem to have today.
We're talking to Candace Taylor, author of the book Counterculture, The American Coffee Shop Waitress. Not only did they not need the status, some of them were actually trained to do fine dining waitressing, and they really chose to do diner or coffee shop waitressing because of the relationships that they had with the customers and because the ability they had to really be themselves on the job.
Yes. Yeah, that was another, you know, realization that, because I had been working at a sushi restaurant, and, you know, I thought, well, maybe they're working in diners because they just haven't been able to get jobs in other restaurants, or why aren't they managers? A lot of these women were offered management positions, and they said, there's no way I would be a manager. You know, yeah, I don't want to be cut off from my regulars. A lot of them had, who had worked in fine dining, said, you know, I just can't be myself. Juanita, she's in Kentucky. She's like, I'd like to holler at my customers when they walk through the door. And I couldn't do that, you know, if I was working in a, you know, some fancy place. These women are able to be themselves, and that's very liberating in the service industry.
And that's where you get a little bit of that stereotype of the wisecracking waitress. Those people exist, and they're having a wonderful time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they are. I mean, there were. I definitely met waitresses out there that had the beehives and had the wisecracks and chewed gum. Not one did all three of those things, you know, like Flo.
Yeah, right.
But, yeah, they were definitely, they're characters. They have vibrant, you know, over-the-top personalities, a lot of them, because they love people.
There's something that you notice if you live in a town for long enough and you go to the same places long enough, some coffee shops, diners, restaurants have a lot of turnover, and some of them have very little turnover. And when you see the same waiters or waitresses year after year, you know the management's doing something right.
That's a great point. Yeah, and that's usually a good litmus test as to whether or not, you know, for me, whether or not I want to support a business is how they treat their workers. And you're right, if there's a lot of turnover, it's usually not rocket science. I mean, it's usually the management isn't good, or people don't want to stay for a certain reason, or they're hiring the wrong people and then, you know, having to fire them because they've hired the wrong people. In any case, it's a huge sign that something's not quite right.
We're talking to Candace Taylor, author of the book Counterculture, The American Coffee Shop Waitress. There is a sense of community, of loyalty, of continuity, of really long-term stability that these people represent. Is there a generation of waitresses following them doing the same thing?
In a word, no, sadly. There definitely are waitresses who are younger who are doing a great job and who are committed to the work. But I think, you know, we're in a different time and place, and there is different expectations around what work is supposed to be in your life. And, you know, for a lot of these younger waitresses, you know, even if they're good waitresses, a lot of them are thinking, you know, I'm going to do something else with my life. So it's a different attitude. I mean, for these women, they assured me, you know, a lot of them flat out said, I wouldn't do anything else if given the opportunity. I was put on this earth to be a waitress. You know, just like an actress, I think it was Joanne in San Francisco said, just like an actress, I was born to do this. And I have yet to find any younger waitresses believe that or say that. Even if maybe they think that, it's not okay to say that in our society right now. You're supposed to want, you know, bigger and quote-unquote better things, whatever that means. So it's different.
It's very interesting because it says a lot about expectations of class mobility, and in a way the lack of society dignifying jobs that everybody expects and everybody demands, basically.
Yeah, and I had to go through that myself. I mean, that's one of the things I really learned, I'd say, from, you know, writing this book. I really had to reevaluate my position on what success meant and identifying what that was. I was, you know, I graduated from college. I'd had this master's degree. I was still waitressing and was writing this book, and I was so in love with these, you know, with my waitresses and with doing the project, I thought, you know, why would I stop waitressing? You know, just because I thought, well, maybe I should get a real job now because I have this fancy degree. And, you know, it just, I really had to struggle with that. And I ended up just continuing to waitress for many years. And I never, you know, now I work for myself and I have my own company, Tailor Made Culture, and I do multimedia projects. But, you know, I just had to make the decision. Like, it doesn't mean anything to me to go out and get some job so somebody can think that I'm important or because I have a label or a status. So these women taught me that.
And as you write, there are a whole bunch of them who know very well that the people who have made it into the, you know, nicer houses and fancy cars and all of that stuff are riddled with existential doubt and antidepressant prescriptions.
Yeah, it's not the road to happiness. Having a, you know, I think having a job that pays your bills and feeling secure, no matter what that job is, I think is really should be the focus. And especially now, you know, in the economic situation that we're in this country, you know, I'm not saying that everybody should run out and be a waitress, but it's something to consider if it's something you've done before and that you know you're good at, and if you've had a real job and got laid off, you know, and thought, well, what else am I going to do? I mean, waitressing is not a bad job. It's actually, it can be very rewarding for people who want to do it. If you don't want to do it, definitely do not do the job because it just, everybody's miserable. You're miserable. Your customers are miserable. The management's miserable. Do what you love.
There's an interesting, when I first graduated from college years ago, and I was searching for jobs, I needed something to tide me over, and I went around looking for a waitressing job, and there was one place that I'll never forget. They said, are you interested in doing this as a career? I said, honestly, no. They said, well, then you need not apply.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was an independently owned restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I thought, okay, you know, fair enough. One less job that I'll have, but it was such a different way of thinking to my mind then, because I thought everybody was doing was waitressing temporarily. Yeah. In your work, did you find, I know this is about the American coffee shop waitress, but did you find any long-term waiters?
No, I really focused on the waitresses, on the women. A lot of older waiters tended to be more in finer dining restaurants. It was kind of the time, you know, for the older waitress, it was harder, especially in the 60s and 70s, for women to work in finer dining restaurants. As they aged, it was okay if they were younger, but as they aged, it became more acceptable for women to be working in diners. So ironically, you know, they were kind of pushed out of being in fancier restaurants. But for these women, you know, they said they wouldn't work in them anyway. They prefer being in diners.
We're talking to Candace Taylor, author of the book Counterculture, The American Coffee Shop Waitress. Part of their role, besides waiting tables, is some combination, I can't remember exactly how you put it, of psychologist and friend and supporter and all of that. There's a real kind of, I don't think you use the word mother, but almost like mother of the community that, mm-hmm. that this person can fulfill.
Yeah, Faye actually said it better probably than I did. She said, you know, I'm a psychiatrist, a mama, a grandmama. I'm whatever they need me to be, you know. And again, I think it's that innate talent of being able to read somebody, you know, and give them what she thinks they need in that moment. And I think that's why these women are so special. For a lot of their regular customers, when the waitress leaves, it's pretty devastating to the restaurant and to the community. A lot of these waitresses stayed in the same restaurant, but the ones who moved from restaurant to restaurant, their regulars followed them throughout their entire career.
That is
so interesting. As long as they didn't leave the state.
You know? Right.
Esther has customers who drive 4 hours to see her. My first grant that I got was from the California Council for the Humanities, and that grant was just to focus on the relationships between waitresses and their regular customers. And there is a chapter in Counterculture called The Regulars that deals with that issue, because it's a huge impact that these women have on people's lives. Georgina Moore, she was a waitress. She still is at the Gold and Silver in Reno, Nevada. When I interviewed her, she was getting up an hour earlier, and she was getting up at like 4 in the morning so she could go to her regular customer's house, who suddenly had become ill and couldn't come into the restaurant anymore. And he was sick, and he didn't have anybody else to take care of him. And she was there, you know, in the morning before her shift to go to his house to make sure he had everything he needed. And you don't see that today. You see that in a lot of situations. And I just thought that was so incredible that she knew that he needed her and she was there for him.
On top of everything else, you got to make some great portraits and photographs of coffee shops and diners with their chrome and glass and steel and wonderful sugar containers and all of that stuff, and quite colorful, and it seems like it was a lot of fun.
Oh, it was. I mean, these places are just, I love diners, and I just think they are beautiful. There's so many books out there on just diners, you know, and have celebrated diners, but, you know, I found that so little had been really written about the waitresses. And I think that in addition to all that chrome and you know, that kind of pop culture Americana, you know, the red ketchup bottles and the bursts of color that you see in these places, these women were, I think, humanizing, you know, all that steel and really making this place feel like a place you want to go back to again and again. It felt comforting. It felt like home.
What's the next stage of this project?
Actually, the next stage is to do a film documentary, and I am looking for good candidates to be involved in the film. If you know, if anybody out there knows of any older waitresses, 50 and older, who are working in diners or coffee shops, a place with a counter and a large local following, please let me know. You can look me up on my website, which is TaylorMadeCulture, TAYLORMADE, culture.com.
Candace Taylor is the author of the book Counterculture, The American Coffee Shop Waitress. It's published by Cornell University Press. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It was such an honor.
I am very happy now to welcome Karen Armitage. She is the Chief Medical Officer for the New Mexico Department of Health, and she will be speaking tonight. It's part of the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. It's a lecture titled H1N1, Swine Flu and You, and it's at 6:30 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So H1N1 flu, first of all, what is it, and why don't we call it swine flu anymore? Is it the same thing?
You know, I think swine flu is an easy-to-remember name, but a lot of times common names for diseases become a little untrue. In fact, swine flu has a little bit of the flu virus from pigs and a little bit of the flu virus from birds, and it's a combination of human, bird, and swine flus. But it helps people to communicate if they have a common name for it. The CDC has renamed it H1N1 novel influenza.
H1N1, and I guess they don't really have what you would call professional naming people on their staff.
Apparently not.
But what is different about it? I mean, certainly there's a lot of talk about swine flu or H1N1. How is it different, or is it different from any other flu?
The flu family of viruses has clusters and characteristics associated with them. This is the first time we've seen this particular cluster of this family of flu viruses, but there are many, many different clusters of family flu viruses. In fact, every year, a different cluster of a mix of flu viruses circulate, which is why we have to make a new flu vaccine every year.
Is there a vaccine so far for this cluster?
There is a vaccine. It has been developed. It's been tested, and it's gone through, as you may already know, flu vaccine is developed and tested through a similar system every year. And so the new circulating virus has also been used to produce a new vaccine in the same system, in the same way. But it's unique in that we haven't seen this particular clustering of flu virus components. And so it has a name, and we're making a vaccine against it. I think it's important to remember the way you make the vaccine and the idea of a vaccine is actually not new. It's routine, but it's a new strain of flu virus that we haven't seen in that combination.
When you say combination, is it more than one actual species of virus?
I think it's helpful to think about viruses as being very simple forms of life. They don't have very much inside them. They're basically not able to reproduce by themselves or to grow or to develop. They have to go into a little cell and take over the machinery in order to create more copies of themselves. So H and N refer to two recognizable parts of the virus. And that's how we type them. Like this is H1N1, this is H2N3. That's how we name them. And that's how we prepare a vaccine against them. But they're actually quite simple forms of life. They're exceptionally small. Can't really see them without an electron microscope. And they invade cells, our cells, very much like a germ might infect our body. I mean, they're very, very tiny.
And potentially very dangerous. Who is most vulnerable to the H1N1 virus and to flu in general?
I think we speak of flu in general. We think of folks being most susceptible if they're very young or if they're very senior, over 65, or if they have an underlying health condition that makes it hard for them to fight back, to fight the virus. H1N1 has been a little different in that what we notice is folks that are a little older aren't as likely to be infected.
Interesting. Well, do we know why that is?
The reason that we believe is true, although it'll be interesting to see how this turns out over time, is that the older people are, the more likely they've seen multiple years of flu outbreaks, and the more skilled their immune system is at detecting flu early and mounting response so they don't get it.
But again, that's not true of all flus. It's true of this one in particular.
Well, there is some evidence that having had, for example, let's say that a woman, 60, has had real influenza 4 or 5 times in her life. And those influenza viruses were sort of a mix of types. She has an immune system that's been sort of trained to look for influenza. And that may be the advantage that older people have in this H1N1 outbreak, is that they've lived longer and their own bodies now recognize flu earlier and they can mount a response and perhaps not be infected.
Is the swine flu H1N1 what you would at this point call an epidemic in the United States, in the world, in New Mexico?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good question. We're referring to it as a pandemic. And pandemics imply that a virus has spread outside a state, outside a country, to separate countries, and to other continents. So pandemic really means worldwide. This is a pandemic. It is by definition mild so far. Most people who get it are not terribly sick, but it is a pandemic in that it spread over the world, more or less.
So, first of all, what kind of prevention should people be doing in New Mexico?
Well, as you know, there isn't a widely distributed vaccine for this yet,
right.
Although we do expect to have enough vaccine over the next month or two. We expect to be able to distribute enough vaccine, and we're hopeful that we'll be able to vaccinate most people who want to be vaccinated. But if you think about that, the most protective thing you can do is to wash your hands, take good care of yourself, and stay home if you're sick so that you don't spread this to others in the workplace or at school.
Washing your hands is so very simple, and it's hard to remember that it's really effective. But washing your hands can be the difference between getting the flu, any kind of flu, and not getting it.
I completely agree. It seems simple to us, and yet it actually underlies much of the disease we see in the world. Hand washing is a major determinant of disease. Our ability to have clean water and dispose of sewage safely and to have wholesome foods, those are all big predictors of major disease. And we don't see so much of those diseases in the U.S. right now or in developed countries, but there are still major problems with those diseases in some parts of the world that are based on basic sanitation.
At the same time, and I don't want to contradict what we're saying about washing your hands, people can go overboard in sanitizing everything and practically getting an autoclave to wash your dishes and things like that.
Well, clean enough is might be a good way to put it. Let's be clean enough. I think washing your hands with ordinary soap and water is a great way to reduce your risk of getting the flu.
And for example, you don't need antibacterial soap.
It doesn't seem to make much difference in the transmission of disease. Now, the hand alcohol hand rubs are a little different. They're not really a soap. They're just a treatment for your skin if you can't wash with soap and water. And they do seem to reduce transmission of flu virus.
We're talking to Karen Armitage, Chief Medical Officer for the New Mexico Department of Health. So what is the situation in New Mexico? How many people have had H1N1 flu? How many people have died from it? What are you seeing?
That's a very good question. As you may have already figured out, since most people who get this infection are mildly ill, not ill enough perhaps even to go to the doctor, we don't really know how many cases we've had. What we can count is how many people are hospitalized and how many people die. At this time in New Mexico, we've had a dozen people who've died of H1N1 infection, and many more dozens of people who've been hospitalized. But we've had many, many reports of what we call influenza-like illness. We refer to that as ILI. Influenza-like illness is monitored by a few doctors and clinics all over the state. They monitor all the time, year-round. And if they see a case of influenza-like illness, they test it for us. So we look at those rates of influenza-like illness, and what we're seeing in those surveillance sites and also in doctors' offices and hospitals is more people have this infection than they did last week or the week before that. So we're looking at rising numbers of influenza-like illness, and almost all of that is believed to be due at this time to H1N1 influenza.
It seems also that people are getting the flu earlier in the season than they usually do.
You are exactly right. As someone who works in public health all the time, I'm used to seeing flu peak sometime in January, or maybe February, or in an earlier December. You'll recall that this new flu version showed up in March. We have some sense that it never really left, that it's sort of been hanging around, and we're now seeing a peak as it's spread through a larger number of people. But you're right, it's an early flu season for us. I think it's important for listeners to know we actually expect the normal flu may return in its normal time, maybe in December or January. And that's why it's important for folks to consider getting regular old flu shot. And also, when H1N1 flu shot is available, we hope they'll consider getting that shot too.
So those are two different things, and they don't overlap in how they work. The H1N1 vaccine will only work against H1N1, and the regular flu shot will only work against the regular flu.
In general, I think it's interesting to think about flu vaccine as being something that must be made every year. You know, normally if you think about a vaccine, like a vaccine against, say, tetanus or a vaccine against measles, you don't have to remake those. It's stable. The special thing about the flu vaccine is it's able to change very quickly, so quickly that if you had the flu last year, you might still get the flu next year if it's a different family of strains, a cluster of specific flu viruses. So every year they make a new vaccine, and right now they've made a new vaccine for the widely circulating H1N1. Virus.
The people who have had H1N1 who have been hospitalized or who have died of it, are they mostly or all people with those specific vulnerabilities that you were talking about earlier?
Most of them had some pre-existing condition, or they have another risk factor, like their age or their condition that they have. But there have been very otherwise healthy people, and that's actually not so unusual either. Every year, influenza does make some very healthy people sick enough that they're hospitalized, and we do have folks who die of flu each year, even though we wouldn't have predicted it. Most folks who get very sick with the flu have what you talked about. They either are at risk because of age, or they have an underlying medical condition or health condition that makes it harder for them to recover.
When was the great flu epidemic of the 20th century?
Most people refer to the pandemic of 1917-1918. Estimates at the time were 21 million died 21 million people died worldwide. There have been estimates that it may have been higher. As you might expect, we weren't as careful or as good at counting specific kinds of death because this was early in the 20th century. But I wanted, I think it's good that you raised that, because that was an example of a pandemic flu that was very serious and made a lot of people very sick.
And a lot of people died of the flu at that time.
Yes, and it wasn't what I would consider mild, but it started out as mild. And that's why we're very interested in stopping this pandemic as soon as we can, by asking folks to prevent the disease if they can, and by encouraging folks to get a vaccination.
There are, I was reading the CDC website, Centers for Disease Control, which is very easy to access. If you have a computer and you just Google CDC, it'll come right up. Some people are doing swine flu parties, which is that they're getting one person who's infected to come to a party and infect everybody else. Not a good idea.
You know, not from a public health physician's perspective, no. There were chickenpox parties 30 or 40 years ago. Some of your listeners may remember that too. When you see that occasionally a mild disease leads to a very serious illness or even death, it keeps you from thinking the idea of a flu party is a good idea. You certainly wouldn't want to look back on it and say, we intentionally did this, and some of these folks had a very poor outcome. But you can understand why families might think about that. They'd like for their children to become immune to the flu. We're suggesting that families have their kids vaccinated against the flu.
So what are the symptoms of it that maybe are not the same as other flu symptoms? Or is it just the same?
You know, we talked about, you and I talked a little bit before we came on the air, about how different flus might be, and that each flu variant might be quite different. One of the things that's been noticed about this flu variant is that the incubation period seems to be quite short. People go from not being sick to being sick in a relatively short period of time, just a day or two. Sometimes it takes longer for people to get a traditional seasonal flu.
So in a traditional flu, you might sneeze on me and 2 weeks later I get the flu.
Well, you know, I tend to think of the incubation window as being a little wider, a little longer, and so maybe you'd get sick on the third day or the fourth day. But this flu, people seem to become ill or have symptoms pretty quickly.
So within a day or two?
Within a day or two.
Ah.
So that's helpful for people to know. If you were with somebody who was sick and you're perfectly well 3 or 4 days later, you're probably not going to get sick from that contact with someone who has the flu. Other differences have to do with this flu seems to be more contagious to young people. And we think that may be because folks who've seen many flu seasons have a little more resistance to this currently circulating flu. So that's another difference.
So the symptoms of it are headache, fever, body ache, sneezing, sniffling, but also some people have nausea and vomiting.
They do. And if you think about it, some people feel so ill and their bodies respond so strongly that nausea and vomiting may be a part of that. Also, the flu virus can infect all cell lines in the body, and so that may be a presentation. That may be why people get nausea and vomiting. Not always, but some.
So once you've got the flu, if you want to know if it's H1N1, how can you find out?
Well, this is going to sound funny, but the simple answer is we're almost certain you do have H1N1 if you get flu symptoms, and that's because there aren't any other circulating flu types of any number. So if people have what we call classic influenza-like illness, it's overwhelmingly likely that they have H1N1. I think that would be important to know. It would save you having to have a test done. It would save you having to talk with the doctor. Do you think I have this type of flu? But it may be harder for folks to decide, do I have just a regular cold, or do I really have the flu?
So how should they treat themselves or have their families or friends or whatever treat them if they start to come down with these symptoms?
I recommend that people play it safe assume that you might have the flu if you begin to get sick, and then pay attention to your symptoms. Most people who have the flu get a fever. Not all, but most. So if you have a way to measure your temperature and your temperature is 100 degrees or more, it's more likely, if you have also a sore throat or a cough, that you actually have the flu. Folks may also want to think about how sick they feel. This is a mild flu, but most folks say that they feel tired and that they need to go to bed. If you think about a common cold, people go right on with whatever they're doing. They walk their dog, they go to work. It's not something that makes them stop and lie down for a day or two. So I think that's another way to be more suspicious that you might have the flu, is that you feel much sicker than you would with, say, a normal cold or with allergies if you have them.
So you go to bed and what? Drink chicken soup?
You know, it sounds funny, but certainly rest, liquids, and just supportive care make people feel much better. I also think it's important to remember that your immune system is what's going to take care of this disease. And your immune system works better if you're rested, if you have plenty of fluids, and if you're eating healthy foods.
Are there any drugs or medications or even over-the-counter stuff that really combat it better, that help your own immune system to combat it?
There is a certain class of drugs. We call them antivirals. They basically slow the virus's ability to make copies of itself, which is how it creates all this mayhem. And those antiviral drugs, can slow the virus down enough for your immune system to take over and clean it up. We're only using antiviral drugs in serious cases because these drugs are the flu is very good at learning to manage these medicines, so we use them only when we think they'll make a difference. So, for example, if you have the flu and you're in the hospital, someone will give you antiviral medicines to help your immune system get a hold on the flu and get over it. If you're someone who has a risk factor, like let's say you have a serious underlying medical condition like diabetes or serious asthma, those folks, if they get the flu, should take antivirals because they're more likely to have a serious problem.
How do you know when you should go to the hospital?
That's a very good question. There are some warning signs that you may want to consider. I'll talk first about the warning signs for adults. If adults who have what they think is the flu experience difficulty breathing, or a shortness of breath, not able to get your breath, if they feel a great deal of pain in their chest or their abdomen, if they feel a sort of dizzy, or their family describes them as being confused, or if they are not able to hold liquids down or stop vomiting for a period of a day or so, it's good for them to get an evaluation, and they may need to be hospitalized in order to get better.
There is treatment of disease, and then there is also treatment of fear of the disease. You, before we went on the air, you were calling it hysteria.
Yeah.
And that's, in a way, harder to treat.
I think it's very hard for folks to know what to do when they feel very worried about the flu, because right now we're just starting to get the vaccine. So I think sometimes we are very, very frightened of this disease, and we may or may not make good decisions while we're very frightened. I always encourage people to stick to the facts, get a good, solid piece of advice from an agency like the CDC or the Department of Health, and then get some help with this real fear. There are several places people can call and talk about the flu or ask questions about the flu. And I really encourage folks, if they're computer types, to learn as much as they can by pulling up excellent websites. I think it's important to remember that our best decisions are based on evidence or facts. And while we may feel very frightened, it's still important to make good decisions based on evidence and facts.
What numbers can they call and what websites should they look at?
Let me give you a couple of websites that I think have a section for the public and a section for different groups like parents, kids, and other groups. That website is cdc.gov.
cdc.gov.
There you go, cdc.gov. There's also a phone number you can call if you have a concern about H1N1 and you'd like to talk with someone. That number is 1-800-CDC-INFO. info, CDC info.
1-800-CDC-INFO, whatever that translates into numbers.
I'll actually give you that number because I think that can be sort of frustrating for folks. That number is 1-800-232-4636.
Excellent. So people can actually talk to a person and say, mm-hmm. I'm feeling this, I'm feeling that, and get some decent advice.
Or learn more about, is there a flu vaccine in my neighborhood? What should I worry about with my child? There is another number that folks can call here in New Mexico and talk with a registered nurse. Mm-hmm. This is best for folks who might have symptoms of flu and want to discuss it and have need more information. That number is 1-877-725-2552.
Excellent. And 877, that's a toll-free number, 725-2552. And by the way, if you're a computer type, this show will be podcast starting shortly after the show is over, so you can always listen to it again and get all that information. So you are the chief medical officer for the New Mexico Department of Health. What is the mood like around the Department of Health? Are people worried about this? Is it just yet another thing you guys are used to it because you're public health officers?
You know, we're actually used to flu season every year, but this is a special one for us because it essentially has required us to double all of our efforts. There are two flus that we expect may circulate, and this flu came early for us, and we didn't have a vaccine. So I think I would describe the environment at the Department of Health is very, very busy right now.
Your tax dollars at work.
That's right.
In a good way.
In a good way.
So what about face masks? Do you recommend, I mean, there are some people who work in public, I've seen in airports and post office and things like that. Is it a good thing to wear a face mask?
You know, the data about how much face masks work isn't very good. They're relatively uncomfortable to wear. They get saturated with moisture because we breathe through them. People take them off and put them on sometimes based on their perception of risk, but that may or may not be where they're at most risk. So what we're advising is if you're a healthcare provider in an environment, that you follow the CDC guidelines for the use of face masks. And if you're a member of the public, certainly if you're following all the other requirements, hand washing, getting a vaccine, staying home if you're sick, covering your cough and sneeze with a tissue and washing your hands.
And then throwing the tissue out.
Throwing it out and actually washing your hands. I have to tell you that I heard a child describe the new technique of coughing into the crook of your arm as the Dracula cough, which I thought was very funny when they throw their arm up. So
that's funny.
The Dracula cough.
Right, yeah. Right. Karen Armitage is the Chief Medical Officer for the New Mexico Department of Health. Anything else you want to let people know about H1N1 swine flu?
I hope that folks will continue to seek out vaccine when it comes to their community and will get a vaccination to protect themselves and the ones they love. We'd love for them to contact us at the Department of Health, and you can also go to our website to find out specifically what New Mexico is doing and what new developments there are in H1N1 flu here in our state. And that website is health.state.nm.us.
And I bet if you Google New Mexico Department of Health, you'll get it just as quick.
It's right. It'll pop right up.
Any phone numbers?
Well, we have several phone numbers that have to do with needing to get more information about certain virus, certain medications, or needing to report disease. But most of our phone number access is for providers and clinics. But what folks can do is at the website, the health department website, there are alternatives for contacting us in other ways, sending us an email, giving us a call on a general line. There are also some lines that have just information. There's not a person that answers the phone. And those numbers are also on the website.
On the website. Karen Armitage will be speaking tonight at the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. It's part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science lecture series. It's at 6 o'clock tonight at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex. I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks for helping us get the message out about H1N1 influenza.
And the Santa Fe Alliance for Science can be found on the web at SFAFS, as in Santa Fe Alliance for Science, .org. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. My email is radiocafe@ksfr.org, and my website, which is a podcast site where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, is santafe.radiocafe.org. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.